It's been decades since anyone's made meaningful advancements in the hair health industry. But a new world of science and research has just changed the way we think about hair and its relationship to our overall health. It's not just genetics that have it out for your hair. Stress, DHT levels, diet, and even environmental toxins all have been discovered to compromise your hair health. Whatever the causes, you're catching your reflection in the mirror and you're concerned. Maybe you've tried the drugs in the market. Maybe you're interested in something that's 100% drug-free. Leveraging the latest and greatest in biotechnology, Nutrafol's botanical ingredients are shown to improve hair without compromising sexual health or any other kind. In fact, one of Nutrafol's key ingredients, saw palmetto, has been shown to support healthier libido. Huh? So try Nutrafol. To get the first month's supply with subscription for $10, visit Nutrafol.com and use the promo code HOOPS during checkout. That's the first month's supply with subscription for $10. Nutrafol.com. Promo code HOOPS. Welcome into the All Ball Podcast. I'm your podcast host, Doug Gottlieb. Hey, by the way, make sure you listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show. We do it live every day, Monday through Friday, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific. You can listen to it on any of your terrestrial radio stations, on Sirius XM Channel 83. You can also go to foxsportsradio.com. There's a myriad of ways. Doug Gottlieb Show, daily. Follow me on Twitter, at Gottlieb Show. Man, do we have a good pod for you. I mean, we got a lot for you. Let me quickly give you a couple things since last we spoke. Obviously, LeBron James, now member of the Lakers, and I've told people who listen on radio or on Cowherd Show, listen, I don't love the plan, but one of the things we never do, or we do a terrible job of in sports, is we act like there's a blank canvas, right? Have you ever noticed that? We're like, oh, why didn't LeBron create the perfect team in L.A., you know, with like perfect shooters and like, that's not how it works. If you want to come to L.A., like, all right, we got these young guys. We got some cap space. We got Luol Deng's contract that we're trying to either get rid of or smooth. Like, we got some things working. We got some draft picks, but they're not like a top five draft pick. Like, this is kind of what we got. It's not a blank canvas. Additionally, with the free agents that you can add, it's like, well, I can't believe they didn't add more shooting. Okay, well, who was available? Like, who was available? They couldn't pay, you know, Trevor Ariza to bring him back. Didn't have that kind of money, you know? So they got Lance Stephenson, not a big money deal. They got Rajon Rondo, which they probably paid him a little bit more than $8 million, but it's only a one-year deal. Like, dude, getting guys for 1 year is not easy. You know, would I have gone with J.J. Redick? Yeah, I would have gone with J.J. Redick ahead of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope. The one issue, though, with getting rid of Kentavious Caldwell-Pope is that's kind of a wink-wink, nod-nod deal because he, too, is rep by Rich Paul. So, again, this is not sports isn't played in a vacuum. There's no blank canvas. The Lakers are doing the best they can. The only thing I would have done differently was I would at least engage with J.J. Now, look, J.J. probably shows some loyalty to the 76ers. They also lost some of their other shooters to free agency, but also, like, look, they overpaid him for 1 year to maintain cap space, so to take less, I think he's making $12 million, which Kentavious Caldwell-Pope was making. You know, he might have only taken that amount because he could still live in Brooklyn and still make that schlep to Philadelphia for games on game day, not have to, and like a payback for overpaying him last year. He made like $23 million or something last year, right? Something crazy. Anyway, point being, It's not just as easy as, okay, let's just like pick dream guys and put them dream team. You do the best you can with what you got and what you can acquire and who's on the market. And you know what? This is not a terrible roster. They're dependent on, if they remain with Brandon Ingram, they don't trade him. Brandon Ingram to improve as a shooter. He should. He's 20 years old. Josh Hart to improve. He should. He's only going to his second year in the league. Kyle Kuzma to improve. He should. Lonzo Ball couldn't get any worse as a shooter. The idea is all of those young guys, plus they added Svi Mihailuk and Mo Wagner, you couple that with the veterans they have, and then here's the big thing. Look at that roster. Tell me who their small ball five is. I think it's LeBron James. When I hear people say LeBron wants to play more from the post, they want to play fast, and they want playmakers, my guess is, just guess, educated guess, is this is a team that's going to be athletic, that's going to challenge you, depend upon their young players to get better. If they don't make a Kawhi Leonard trade, But LeBron James will be their small ball five. I think he liked being able to take plays off guarding Draymond Green, guarding P.J. Tucker. He'll be able to guard those. Every team is trying to find their own Draymond Green. And while LeBron James is still awesome, he can't play at the same level defensively that he used to. And he's not going to be the same, have the same level of explosiveness. Why not create a mismatch playing at center? As opposed to when they played him at four, most of the time, or point or four, most of the time in both Miami and in Cleveland. I think it's a smart idea. And I think, again, based upon what they have, what they had, maintaining the cap space, and what they want to ultimately be, I kind of like it. I don't love it, but I like it, and I get it, and I do think it's smart for LeBron 4.0 to think, look, my first step is going to slow down. How can I maintain my level of dominance? Play him at center. Play him at center. He's not a great shot blocker. He's not a great rebounder. But you mean to tell me that he can't be a really good rebounder playing center if you have rebounding? Like, by the way, one thing they really like about Lonzo Ball is a really good rebounding guard. Excellent rebounding guard. So it's not perfect, but it wasn't a blank canvas that they started with. So some of this Laker stuff does make a lot of sense, and Houston keeps adding scoring pieces when the reason they took the next step last year was their defense, not because of their scoring. All right, so then we have what Oklahoma City did. And obviously, look, having spent time in Oklahoma City, having lived there, done national radio, done radio there, and then I still do radio locally in WWLS, I can only tell you that I understand what it feels like to be Paul George, to have a city wrap their arms around you and go like, hey, man, you stay. We love you here. And it is an easier pace of life than being in LA. What I'm blown away by, though, is that Paul George didn't even have a meeting with the Lakers. Like, look, dude, you blew up the Indiana thing. And granted, your vision of you didn't know Oklahoma City would fit you. You didn't think you could ever, you would never have without Russell Westbrook there. But this is something that's funny to me or interesting to me. Russell Westbrook was like his best buddy, right? They get done with the season. They're inseparable. They're working out together. They're hanging out together. He let his guard down. Hey, see my family. Be part of what I am. I want you that badly. I follow Russell Westbrook on Instagram, and I noticed he was in San Diego last week with his Brodies, his best friends. This is after Paul George re-upped with the Oklahoma City Thunder. You know who wasn't there? Paul George. You know why? Because he's really not his best friend. He really, and look, I give him a ton of credit. This was a dude who really needed Paul George to re-sign for his own reputation. He did a great job of recruiting. And they did such a good job that Paul George did not take another visit. And so if you're listening to this and you're a parent of a kid who's going to be recruited or you're going to be recruited yourself, and college coaches are listening to this, they know it so well. Never commit on your first visit. Doesn't mean you don't commit to the school from your first visit, but go see other places, give it perspective. And for a guy who blew up Indiana, to go to L.A., to not even have a meeting with the Lakers, it just doesn't strike me as a guy who's really sharp or is real has great conviction in his decision. That said, Oklahoma City has to get rid of Carmelo Anthony, not just for the luxury tax, but because he's toxic. I don't think it makes them a championship-caliber team because you still have the Andre Roberson can't shoot. And as good as Steven Adams is, he's only really good, you know, 10, 12 feet and in. That just shrinks the court around Russell Westbrook, who's not a great three-point shooter, needs space to drive, and Paul George, and, you know, whoever else they're going to. Even when they play small, the court seems shrunk in Oklahoma City. Do I think it makes them competitive? Yes. And really, that's what their beliefs are. As the longer we can stay competitive in Oklahoma City, eventually it'll come back around us. Golden State may implode or have injuries. You know, we'll see. The Lakers might not be there yet. The Spurs appear to be aged. Houston, I don't think, is better. Losing Ariza and losing Bamute and potentially adding Carmelo or adding Swaggy, whoever they add there, is going to be more offensive, where defensive. I do actually think, I believe, that Oklahoma City is just going to sit there and they'll be the stalk horse Everybody else falls apart. We still have Paul George. We still have Russell Westbrook. We got other guys that play very, very good defense. We find enough shot makers around them, we're going to be okay. That makes some sense. All right, we have a great podcast for you upcoming. We're going to take you into the world of the WNBA. You're going to hear from David Griffin, who, of course, was the general manager of LeBron's Cleveland Cavaliers. Wait to hear what he says about the narrative that Kyrie Irving could not win before LeBron got there. Pretty interesting. And Joe Varden will join us from Cleveland.com. He's got some great insight into what it was really like with LeBron. But LeBron is a Laker. It does change the NBA, eliminates Cleveland from playoff likelihood, and definitely not a championship caliber team. I don't think it's death to the East. I think people are massively overreacting. I think Milwaukee's going to be really good. I think Boston's going to be obviously the clear favorite. You still have Toronto. You still have Philadelphia. Those young teams are going to get better. But, you know, like, look, there's a strong likelihood Boston, if they're at full strength, is every bit as good as the Golden State Warriors. That's because the Warriors, when you add Boogie Cousins, that changes who you are. If Boogie plays major minutes, they're no longer a team that can switch everything. They're no longer the Hampton Five. They may be more effective at times offensively, but that's with a post player. He can shoot. He can stretch you out. But it changes who they are defensively, and defense is where they shut off people for. Let's turn to the WNBA. Friend of mine, Nikki Collins. Do I need to do the official, like, Nicole Collins, the head coach of the Atlanta Dream? She joins us here on the All Ball podcast. How do you want me to address you? Coach? Head coach? Nikki? Nicole? What do you want me to do?
Definitely not Nicole. Come on. I don't think I've... Nicole on anything but my birth certificate. So, let's roll with Nikki.
All right, fair enough. The pride of Platteville joining us here on the All Ball podcast. At the time of this recording, you guys played an early game on Wednesday, and you not only dominated Elena Della Don's team, that's the best you guys have played all year?
Yeah, I would say without question. I mean, we had four players with 20 points and 5 assists.
This is, how many games have you played, these early games where they try and fill up the arena with camp kids? This is what, 4 or 5 on the year?
This is our fifth. We had by far the most of any WNBA team. So we got everybody's road early game.
So what's that like in terms of preparation? You know, like, do you guys do a pregame meal? Do you get them up at 7 to kind of get them up and around? Or do you let, you know, they're grown women, do you let them, you know, whenever they want to stagger into the arena, they stagger in the arena? How have you worked it?
No, we're pretty consistent. 11's not a horrible time for us because it's our practice slot at home as well. So in some ways, we do end up kind of getting them up, and we're more in that between 7:30 and 8, and we do a breakfast and a short film session, and sometimes we tape down a court to do baseline and sideline out of bounds, and sometimes we just watch the video. But we kind of go from there, give them enough time to pack their bags and get to the arena because we want to be here 2 hours early to really be in a routine.
Nikki Collin joining us here on the All Ball podcast. Okay, so for people who don't know your background, started your career at Purdue as a player, transferred to Marquette, a great career at Marquette, played overseas, came back, assistant, let me make sure I get it all right? Colorado State, and then to Vandy, right? And then
for a
hot second, then to Louisville, then to Arkansas, then the Florida Gulf Coast as an assistant, then the Connecticut Sun, and then this is your first head coaching gig. You've been an assistant for a long time. You're a player and a really good one. But to have your first head coaching gig as in the WNBA, essentially the highest level of women's basketball, what's that like for you?
Yeah, it's a little crazy. I certainly, I've always said I didn't take the straightest line path to where I'm at and kind of meandered along the way and became a mom and, you know, obviously the spouse of someone who was established in his career in coaching. And so, you know, it certainly wasn't a straight line. And I never had plans to necessarily be in the WNBA, but when the opportunity presented itself to work for Kurt Miller in Connecticut, who's, you know, a mentor to me and really one of my best friends, you know, I just thought, hey, if there's ever a time to do it, it's now. And kind of fell in love with the league in it. Really, a lot of it is my personality, my background in engineering. I love the salary cap. I love free agency. The schedule is insane. for 5 months, but then I get to be a stay-at-home mom for seven and do some scouting from home. And so, you know, just kind of a unique system, but one that I love. And, you know, after 2 years in Connecticut, just this opportunity came up, and I certainly wasn't necessarily searching to become a head coach in the W. It just kind of happened pretty organically, and the more I got to know the owners and the situation, it felt really good. And so, yeah, here I am, 43, first head coaching job.
Yeah, well, listen, I want you to do really, really well, because I remember a couple years ago calling different athletic directors going like, hey, you got to be nuts. This woman is awesome. She has no baggage. You know, you need to hire her. And, like, you know, talking low, mid-major, Division I level, like, yeah, I don't know. She hasn't been a head coach. I don't know. And now you're a head coach and a really good one. And putting, you had to put together an entire team in Atlanta. Like, it is, I know you're not the type of person that wants to give the finger to people who at the Division I level weren't giving you a head coaching job, but I do. I like to be that person. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, things happen for a reason. I'm a big believer in that. And I know that, you know, it was ironic because 9 months after, you know, I couldn't get involved in some college head coaching jobs that I really thought I was earmarked for, you know, ones that I thought fit my personality and my family background and my faith and those type of things. You know, when I couldn't get an interview at a couple places that I really thought were good fits for me, and then 9 months later to get offered a job at this level coaching pros in a league where there's only 12 coaches, you know, it's crazy, you know, but sometimes it's just the moment and the opportunity and the right people and the right connections, and that's what this business is about. We all know it's networking.
You're in the people business, but being in the people business, it's different coaching women as opposed to coaching girls. What's the biggest adjustment in coaching women? Women with families, women in relationships, all different kinds of relationships, diverse relationships. What's that like for you?
Well, I think in general, coaching pros, you know, you kind of take your mentor hat off because you spend a lot of years in college, you know, and your job is the mentor. You know, and in some ways you get to the pro level and it's about organizing the pieces and getting them to trust you. You know, I'm kind of who I am, and I'm very much I'm going to love on them. I'm crazy passionate. I'm going to high five them when they make a good play. I'm going to question them when I'm frustrated. But I think they're going to know what I'm thinking. And, you know, I try to be transparent and not play games. And pros just don't want you to play games. You know, they want to know the way it is. They want feedback. You know, so sometimes it's simplifying. It's really simplifying with them. And the toughest part about moving from college to the pros is really the lack of practice time. You know, the games come fast and furious. And so it's a lot of prep work behind the scenes, and then a lot of walkthrough and a lot of teaching and a lot of simplifying. I mean, I love that about the pro game because every possession matters and everybody's good. But it's tough sometimes when you don't play well and you really just want to get back out on the practice court and teach that. It's hard to do that. It's really hard to do that at this level. But they learn faster and they understand terminology. You're not teaching terminology for the first time.
Nikki Collins, the first-year head coach of the Atlanta Dream. They're 10-9 on the season. They just dominated the Washington Mystics. She's joining us here on the All Ball podcast. What about the use of analytics in the women's pro game? I happened to peer at your game and some of the stats. I mean, you guys were, for example, this last game, you just won. You come off the court. You guys are 11-18 from three, but only 18 threes to 68 shots. How does the use of analytics, the use of the three-point shot, at the highest level of women's basketball compare to the men at the highest level?
Yeah, I think I would say that I love the analytics, but I also understand my own team. And so while you want, I mean, we were efficient, so that was important to me. I certainly think that we know that you want to eliminate mid-range shots and shoot layups and threes. And I have challenged this team to shoot more threes and to trust the pass and make extra passes. You know, we're a team that's usually more athletic than our opponents. So our ability to get into the paint and finish and get to the foul line, you know, as I've taken over this organization, it's been about, hey, I want to do that, but I also want to get in there and make the extra and shoot threes. And even if we're shooting 29% from three, you know, we're going to understand our effective field goal percentage. And, And so, you know, you're not going to look at the Atlanta Dream's offensive numbers and be really impressed at this point, because I think it's a work in progress. And it's about building your roster and getting them to understand, because they haven't typically played analytically here. But it's huge. I mean, we're all any edge that you can have at this level. We don't sign long-term contracts. You know, I've got a two-year contract. I need to win. And so I'm going to trust what the numbers tell me. But at the same time, there's a little bit of a, I got to feel my team, and I don't want to take some of my team's strengths away to play the numbers game.
Yeah, and that's the point guard. And you obviously seeing the game differently than some people who can only look at the spreadsheet and make their evaluation based upon the spreadsheet. There's been a lot of discussion, you mentioned contracts, about what women should make. Some of the players of the WNBA have said, hey, look, we're just under, look what the men are making, look what we're making. There's a huge disparity. Obviously, without getting into the, you know, all of the nuts and bolts of the TV contracts and the arenas and the number of games, what's your sense in terms of salaries? And keep in mind, obviously, you and I and most people who listen to this podcast should understand that many of these women make a lot more money in the regular season or the other season playing overseas. There's just not that kind of money playing in the WNBA in a shortened season. But should there be more? Should there be a greater compensation for our best players?
Well, I think, you know, we're still a growing league, and we have to do what's right to be successful as a league. You know, we can't put ourselves out of business by not being able to pay the salaries. I certainly would love to see our best players make more money. In fact, our minimum salaries I would love to see get bumped up over time.
What's
we have
minimum?
A lot of room for growth,
what's,
you know, and so – you know, it's a matter of really getting into, you know, from a grassroots effort and getting business partners and corporate partnerships and, you know, people that can bring in fans and can bring in a new fan base and can get our brand out to more people and diverse people so that it comes back to the franchises. And when the franchises are healthy and the league's healthy, you're going to see our players get paid more, you know. So I think it comes down to a grassroots effort as we get out into the community and build corporate partnerships, you know, kind of in our own market.
What's the minimum salary?
You know, the vet minimum this year is 56.1. You know, our rookie contracts, you know, our minimum, like if you haven't put in advanced years of service, you know, is going to be low 40s. So, you know, and then our max salaries are like 115 this year.
Really amazing. 22 years the WNBA has been around, right? Like, that's... it's crazy. That's when you were in college. Did you think this would last this? Because there was a time to which the running kind of thought in the NBA and in men's circles was, hey, that's just a tax write-off. But now many of these teams are privately owned and seem to be self-sufficient. It's kind of crazy. It's been around since 96, and it has not only sustained but become more and more healthy of late. Is that fair?
Yeah. And it's the most successful pro women's league in the history, you know, the history of women's sports. And, you know, it hasn't always been perfect, and we've certainly had expansion and then had teams fold or teams move, you know, and we need to see growth. We need to be in more markets, you know, and reach more people. But the product is so good. The level of play is so high. And you know, I'm proud to be associated with it because I do think we put a good product out on the floor.
You're also a huge basketball fan. I want your reaction kind of quickly to LeBron going to the Lakers. As somebody grew up watching all the old school NBA, what are your thoughts on not just the super team in Golden State, but LeBron leaving his hometown a second time and going to L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously old school. I mean, I grew up a Celtics fan and lived for those Celtic-Laker rivalries. And I just don't think you're going to have those anymore. So, you know, the oldie in me feels that way. I certainly understand the way of the league and it's money and it's opportunity. And, you know, you wouldn't tell anybody in any other profession, hey, don't make a move that's better for your family or better for you personally or your goals. And so I just think we need to understand that it's the way it is. And while, you know, I don't want to picture Larry Bird in any uniform other than a Celtic, you know, uniform or Magic in any other uniform but a Laker uniform, I think we're used to seeing people move teams and go, okay, well, that'll be fun. You know, now the question is the league going to go to not having an Eastern and Western Conference? Because now everybody's going, okay, the balance of power has been in the West, and now it's really in the West. And so do we really want it to be an Eastern-Western Conference championship, or do we want to see the two best teams in the championship? And I think the WNBA made that decision a few years ago, and it's been good for the league because it's we've ended up with the two best teams in the championship, you know, series, which is, I think, healthy for our league to put that product on TV at the end of the year.
Yeah, the problem with it, though, Nikki, is that you run the risk of eliminating interest in the Eastern Seaboard where the greatest percentage of the TV viewers are, right? Like, it sounds good, but you do run that risk. If you have Rockets and Warriors, half the country, especially a really important part of the country, is not going to care. And even if maybe they don't belong there in the finals, the fact is, you need those eyes, much like we talked about with the WNBA. You need as many viewers as possible in order to make ends meet.
Yeah, fair. I guess it all comes down to, are you an NBA fan or are you a Boston Celtics fan? You know, are you an NBA fan or are you a, you know, Sixer fan? You know, and obviously I've got no skin in the game. So for me, just fun to watch the two best teams compete for a championship. Now, there's no doubt that you're going to see those teams in the semifinals then, or you're going to see them in the Western Conference Finals. And then we're going to all say the same thing that, you know, people said in the WNBA a few years ago. It's like, well, this is really the finals, you know, because you'd see the two best teams playing in the semifinals, and then you'd see a sweep in the championship series, you know. And I'm not saying that's going to happen. The NBA is too good. But, you know, and maybe the Sixers, maybe the Celtics are going to be good enough to compete with the Lakers, with the Golden State Warriors, with the Rockets, you know, whoever that is. But, you know, it's not going to be great for the league in general if it's a four-game sweep in the championship series.
Jordan or LeBron?
Jordan.
Why?
I love Jordan's game. You know, I have the utmost respect for LeBron and what he's done and his skill and his power and his athleticism. I loved watching Jordan play out of the triangle and you know, kind of how he played. Now, let's circle that back. I'm still, like, more of a Larry Bird. You know, let's go Bird, Jordan. I'm going to say Bird.
you know, what's funny is I did this yesterday to a buddy of mine, and we were talking about Bird. I was actually – it was a friend. I was talking about rappers and what rapper is what basketball player, you know, like
– Yeah.
Okay, so – and I said – and we started talking about Bird, and I said Bird is essentially he's Eminem. And he's like, no, he didn't. Eminem's got an FU side to him. I was like, you don't remember Bird, right? Like, Bird absolutely. Bird got his first coach fired in the NBA. Bird absolutely had that side to him. You know, the Celtics won 29 games the year before he got there. And this is, they weren't tanking. They were just bad. They won 61 games his first year. They never won, I believe, less than 50 games when he was healthy. Like, somehow in all our discussion about Jordan and LeBron, Bird and, to a lesser extent, Magic, have kind of gotten caught up in the wash and that people don't remember how incredible they were.
Yeah, I think we're old. I think we're just
not old.
We've hit that, you know,
not
but
old.
The
we're not prime.
I know
they don't do that.
And everyone wants to talk about how the game's changed. But, you know, you talk about Bird, you talk about Magic. They were both on kind of super teams.
Right.
You know, created naturally, not necessarily all through free agency. But, you know, they certainly were the two best teams, you know, of the late 80s and in mid to late 80s in that stretch. And so, you know, they dominated the game, and they dominated it with the pass. They dominated scoring. You know, they dominated with their pace and their effort. And, you know, so they were just fun to watch, you know, and you kind of loved one and hated the other, you know. So that's what was fun about it. You just kind of had to love one and hate the other. And I don't really feel like the NBA is like that now. And maybe it's because of the move. You know, but it's kind of like, wow, I like watching Kevin Durant play, but you know, there's no one I hate. You know, there's just no like, and maybe people
Mello,
do hate certain
Mello,
players, but
Mello,
it seems to me like you don't have that.
I can't watch Mello, and I, you know what, you know the other guy who's really good. I mean, he's incredibly talented. I just can't watch. I just not a fan. James Harden. It's between the lack of effort defensively, and then I hate the over dribbling. Just. If you're going to go, but otherwise get rid of the ball. I can't do it. I really struggle with that.
That's the point. Yeah, you know, that's the point guards in us, though. That's the, you know, wanting to see the ball move more. But I agree. I mean, crazy talented, you know, like we can all go, wow, he can really play. Yeah, and you know, I like watching Westbrook more than I like watching Carmelo.
Okay. First park you grew up playing hoop at?
Oh, gosh. In Platteville?
Yeah.
I mean it's kind of
Yes,
like
that's what we're going to do this whole summer. I'm going around. We're interviewing people for All Balls and All Basketball Podcast. I grew up playing basketball a couple places. One was Miles Square Park in Fountain Valley. My dad would get me on like the first wave of games. Get there like 7. They'd start like 7:30. Old men have to call game like 3 back. And they give me like $5. Be like, I'll come back and get you later. $5 is to go across the street and get a pizza and a Gatorade or a Coke or something like that. You started playing basketball where in Platteville?
Yeah, not really at the park though. In my driveway, like yeah. it was just my dad and me. You know, that's really how I started playing. I mean, I thought I was going to be the next Chris Evert and be a tennis player, and then move to Platteville, Wisconsin, and it wasn't exactly a country club kind of town. And so, you know, we just happened to have a driveway with a hoop, and so it was just my dad and me, you know. And then you know, I started playing in youth leagues and playing with the boys in fifth and sixth grade and started going to camps and just went to the gym with my dad, you know, and kind of fell in love with it that way. I wasn't really I didn't really play at the park, you know, and then I learned the older I got, the more I jumped into pickup games at UW-Platteville. And sometimes it was, you know, I used to play a lot of 3-on-3 with the men's baseball staff at UW-Platteville. And, you know, so that's kind of where I was. I could jump into games there at the rec center, mm-hmm. but Platteville wasn't exactly a park.
There
was like one park that had hoops with the chain nets, you know, but it kind of wasn't the hot spot to play.
I completely understand. I've been there for the Disney parade, if you remember. Okay. So the coach that you most try and emulate when you coach.
Yeah, Tom Izzo. I'm like a Tom Izzo disciple when it comes to like the X's and O's side of things. I just, you know, when I really took over as a defensive coordinator, you know, when I was at Arkansas, I just really studied a lot of his stuff. Really defensively, but then, you know, learned to really watch him offensively and see the pace that they played at that was always underrated because you would always talk about, you know, how physical they were and what a great rebounding team they were and how they played defense. But you know, they're really a good offensive pace team as well. So, you know, I think that's the closest I get to someone like that. And then obviously my mentors are people I've worked for. You know, there's things I've taken from Carl Semesco, who's really a spacing and offensive genius, I think, at Florida Gulf Coast, you know, and is a motion guy. And so we don't run motion stuff, but we'll run principles out of, you know, situationally what he liked to do and the spacing on the floor. And, you know, my husband was a high ball screen guy. So, I mean, I understand the ins and outs of the high ball screen. And then Kurt Miller is an incredible coach that I worked with, you know, in Connecticut in terms of pace and tempo and prep. And, you know, I just believe that, you know, I don't want anyone to outwork me, you know. Yep. At the end of the day, we may get beat, but it's not because my team's going to be unprepared.
Becky Hammon is now in front of the bench instead of behind the bench. There's a big push for her to eventually get an NBA job. How challenging do you think that would be? I mean, you have a similar background to her. How challenging would that be for a woman to be a head coach in the NBA from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, you might have a better perspective than me, you know, because I've never coached men. What I can tell you about Becky is I think she can just coach X's and O's, and I think she's a good communicator. And I think when you have mature players, male, female, you just want people around you that know what the hell they're talking about, you know. And so I think you gain respect with your knowledge, and if you're a good communicator, I think people pick up on that quickly. If you care, people pick up on that quickly. So she's obviously made a dent. I've not heard, you know, and certainly it's not like I would expect the Spurs players to be running around and telling us all the things that Becky's not good at. But certainly the respect that I've heard when they've been interviewed about how she communicates and what they think of her is pretty cool. And so, I mean, I'd love to see her break that glass ceiling. You know, I know she had an opportunity to come back and coach women's college basketball at a really high level. And I was so happy when she turned it down because I thought in some ways that would be the easy route for her. And I think she has the ability to do something that nobody's done before. And so someone's going to take a chance on her. you know, and I just want to see her have an opportunity where she can be successful, because the thing I know about first opportunities and breaking glass ceilings is we need her to succeed. We as women need her to succeed, because when she succeeds, then it becomes so much easier for the next owner, the next franchise, to make the same decision. And even yesterday, Christy Tolliver, the Washington Mystics, you know, one of their best players, sat on the bench at Summer League for the Wizards, you know. And so I think players from our league, you know, that want to go into coaching when they're done and have those opportunities and be connected on that side, you know, is good for all of us. Because I don't think that, like, I look at it and say, I'm really happy doing what I'm doing. I'm not sitting here saying I want to coach in the NBA. But I'm also not sitting here thinking I'm not capable of doing it,
right?
Because I absolutely think that I'm capable of doing it. Like, basketball is basketball. X's and O's are X's and O's. Communicating X's and O's, it's good communication, and I think you have to have good communication skills.
Well, so far, so good. 10-9, dominating win over the over Washington. Congrats on the win and on the success, and most importantly, on the family. Looks like everything's going good in the ATL. Let's catch up soon off air. In the meantime, I really appreciate you joining us in All Ball.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been fun.
You can hear him on Saturdays on Deals and Dunks with Joel Myers on Sirius XM NBA Radio. He's David Griffin. He joins us here on the Doug Gottlieb Show. When did you know, David? When did you know he was going to L.A.?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if there's a moment where I knew he was definitely going. I sort of assumed all season that it was either L.A. or Cleveland. There was really not another place that I thought was in the mix. But in terms of, like, knowing the announcement was coming, I certainly wasn't in the know or part of that decision-making process. But it wasn't at all surprising. I mean, going back to the day that KCP signed last year in L.A., the one-year big deal, a Rich Paul client, that certainly enabled Los Angeles to build rapport with somebody who could share with LeBron the vision. And I think it was something that made sense. Looking at it over the long haul, it made sense going back then that that's when it started. So
you think maybe it started because, you know, he doesn't strike me as a quick to snap decision sort of guy, nor does his crew. It was the beginning of the end when they fired you? Like, when do you think the beginning of the end really was?
You know, it's funny. It absolutely was not me. I think, you know, the fact that LeBron was doing one-year deals with regularity there, to me, was indicative at the time that the writing was somewhat on the wall that there was another step in mind for him eventually, that at some point there was a next phase. Because otherwise, if you really were going to be in Cleveland forever, you would have committed long-term and made it so that we could have built in a more mindful, sustainable way. So the other shoe was always sort of going to drop. And I always thought it was foreshadowing or foreboding, I suppose, when I was there, that he was eventually going to leave. I just didn't have any idea when that would be. So I don't think my presence there would have changed anything in terms of what the overall game plan was, what mattered to his family, and more important, what matters to him moving forward outside of basketball. I think Maverick Carter has done a remarkable job with the film production company that they have. They do some very special things, and I think there was no better way to announce your presence with authority in the movie-making industry than to do it in L.A.
Yeah, no question about it. David Griffin, who, of course, you can hear him on Deals and Dunks on Sirius XM on Saturdays. I should point out, you weren't fired. Your contract was not renewed. It was technically a mutual parting of ways. I don't want to make it seem as otherwise. What was your perception of his relationship with Kyrie? And I ask that because there was recently a podcast in which a bunch of guys who cover the Cavs sat down and were like, look, it wasn't until he was gone that all of a sudden we realized they really, really didn't like each other. When you were there, what did you think about those two?
Well, it's really interesting to me now that people want to put that narrative out there with so much conviction. And I know those guys, and I think a lot of what they said was certainly based on things that would give you reason to believe that. But ultimately for me, I probably spent more time with the team on the road than any GM in the league, because when the only thing that marks success is winning a championship, things like team relationships and chemistry and camaraderie matter immeasurably. So I always tried to have my hand on the pulse of that. And I think it's really hard for me to imagine that there was true malice there when I would watch them on the bus laughing and giggling like normal teammates do. They had friction, like all superstars have friction relative to who gets a shot and who gets the opportunity at any given time. That's not unusual, but it was always gone after the moment had passed within a game. So I never looked at them as having a fractured relationship. What I looked at was Kyrie having an inability in the circumstance to really push his boundaries and learn how good he could be, because as a point guard, to do that, you have to have the ball. And I feel like he was ever going to be the one that was called upon to make plays all the time in the setting that LeBron was in. And that's not because LeBron's hard to play with. That's because he's the single most efficient end-game decision maker that has dictated outcome the entire time he's been in the NBA. And every team that wants to win a championship is going to give the most efficient guy the ball. So in Kyrie's case, it made sense that he was going to want a situation eventually where he could be forced to be the man and see if he was capable of delivering.
It's interesting because David Griffin, our guest here on the Doug Gottlieb Show, I do think that Kyrie at times is unfairly characterized. You know, people talk about how bad the Cavs were before LeBron got there. And while that's fair, you guys performed a roster overhaul, not just adding Kevin Love, but also adding other pieces. And he was finally healthy. They were finally maturing. They had had so much turnover and tumult that no one would have been successful, especially he played 8 games in college. How fair is the characterization that Kyrie couldn't win at all unless LeBron got there?
How fair? I was in the middle of telling you that. So Kyrie was, after playing 11 college games, he was on a team that was ultimately trying to do the same things Philadelphia later did. We were the process without the rhetoric that entire time.
Let's start that again. Kyrie before LeBron. They were tanking. They were trusting the process without the rhetoric, right? That's what you said?
Yeah. I mean, and really what it was the idea was we were going to play towards free agency in that year. And when I took over, making sure that Kyrie committed long-term to the organization was the number one job. And as part of that, when we met and talked about the future of the team, we shared the idea of several free agent names with him. These are the people that we would like to surround you with. This would be similar to how we built around Steve Nash in Phoenix. This is what we want it to look like. And Kyrie was very much a partner in the process of going out and recruiting all of the free agents that were waiting on LeBron to make his decision. And we never believed LeBron was coming back when he did, because we sort of anticipated he would take the opportunity to watch from afar whether or not our front office was able to deliver on anything we said we would. And we were really blessed that he made the decision to come home when he did and bought into the vision we had of the way we would build around him. But what happened as a result is everybody that Kyrie recruited had to make decisions to go elsewhere. And Kyrie went from being the number one guy on his team that he helped recruit to being number two. And so his experience changed virtually overnight from what he spent the rest of the time believing was going to happen. So he was put in the most unfair position of everyone. And I thought dealt with it incredibly well and wanted to win when it was all about the right thing. But you're talking about a kid who played 11 college games, was on a team that was intentionally not winning games. So to judge him for his ability to carry us to victory, and that's just an unfair concept all the way around.
What about the idea that he wants to be in New York? Do you believe that to be true?
I don't have any idea. He certainly never shared that with me. You know, I think knowing what I know about the situation and knowing that Brad Stevens was someone that he very much believed in and had interest in playing with, and seeing how much he appreciated the Boston culture, even when we would compete against them,
yep,
and how all about each other that team was, it would surprise me if he wanted to leave there at all. If he left there, I think you would think he would go somewhere where he could go with another superstar that he plays with at USA Basketball or that he's friendly with. So I think that's become the most important thing now, if you're going to tank and you're going to play through free agency, you need to give superstars a template from which they can build the team they envision playing with.
Yeah, look, my friends in Boston have said the truth was with Cleveland, I know you weren't there then, but with Cleveland, when he was traded, he wanted to go to San Antonio or Boston. Like this, these other teams, he wanted to go somewhere with great culture, where he felt like you could win, where he felt like guys were professional, and he loves that part about Boston. It doesn't mean they know that he'll never leave, but they don't get any sort of sense that he's any sort of unhappy, even if they were successful in the playoffs without him.
Yeah, no question. And I knew that San Antonio and Boston were places he wanted to be, because once everything had broken out about the trade and the desire to be traded, I knew sort of what those destinations were, and they were all situations that were designed around culture and coach and frankly, opportunity. And ironically, Gordon Hayward is one of the players that he recruited the year LeBron came back. Gordon was restricted at the time in Utah, and Utah would have matched the deal, but Gordon and Kyrie wanted to play together back then as well. So I can't imagine he would leave unless something went terribly wrong.
David Griffin joining us, former general manager of the NBA. Of course, you can listen to the show Deals and Dunks with Joel Myers on Sirius XM NBA Radio. So LeBron's in Los Angeles. What do you think of what seems to be the Lakers' plan, which is, all right, we got some vets that are hyper-competitive guys that have had some turbulence in the past with Rondo, with Born Ready, and even with JaVale McGee. And then you have the young guys and the idea that he's going to play more from the post. What do you think of that as the way to build LeBron's new team in L.A.?
Well, I think from a regular season standpoint, it makes a lot of sense to me to bring in a number of playmakers that know how to play. If you could have really high basketball IQ ancillary playmakers, somebody who can go get a shot and take the burden off LeBron during a regular season, it makes a lot of sense to me. Where I struggle is the notion that they don't have a whole lot of floor spacing around LeBron. And in the playoffs, like I said earlier, he's far and away the most efficient play terminator and dictator of outcome in the NBA. So when it's time to win a playoff game, you're going to play slower and more methodical. He's going to have the ball, and you're going to have to space the court around it. You're not going to be getting stops and running in the break all the time and playing at a breakneck pace, because you've seen every team that does that, Golden State being the very best of all of them. When it comes time to win games, they execute their way to excellence. They're not sprinting their way to excellence. And you can't execute around LeBron if you can't space the court. So come playoff time, when they're really trying to make a difference, and he could take you, me, and any other two people to the playoffs, I think, in a lot of likelihood, other than the fact that the Western Conference is so incredibly good, I can see it working in the regular season. I just wonder what it looks like in the postseason.
Okay, help me out. If you were in the Lakers front office, and, you know, look, they love Josh Hart. They love Kyle Kuzma. I think they like Brandon Ingram, but they're trying to build this core group of young guys around LeBron, and then have those competitive basketball IQ veterans. And I'm sure eventually they'll add some shooting as well. Maybe not this year, maybe in the next year, or maybe if they trade away. What's the proper value for Kawhi Leonard before the season begins?
It's almost impossible for me to know that if I don't know that Kawhi Leonard's healthy. And I think that's why, with Kawhi being in San Antonio, an organization that has been the best in our league over a 21-year period, and ignoring the noise and acting only when they choose to and for the right deal according to them and the price that they feel it, something's worth, they're not going to be nervous. And they're not going to go into the thought of, oh, my God, well, if Kawhi shows up for training camp, what do we do? They're going to be fine. They're going to continue and move along. And because of that, they'll have the opportunity, if they so desire, to have him play in training camp and prove he's healthy. And that's when a godfather-like package gets put on your doorstep. No one's going to give up the kind of asset value it would take to get San Antonio to act, in all likelihood, unless they know unequivocally Kawhi is healthy. So I think this could play out over a very long period of time, because of that. And I don't think it makes any difference what you think your package is at whatever team you're at.
The Rockets did not take the bait, and they let Trevor Ariza walk. Luke Richard and Bob Mute is back with the Clippers as he was a year ago. They felt compelled to re-sign Chris Paul, and they gave him the max. And look, he's a terrific player and a future Hall of Famer, but he does break down, and he's not getting younger. And now there's talk of adding Carmelo Anthony. What's your reaction to the moves that the Rockets have made this offseason?
So, without regard for the Rockets, I believe that every time you change your group and every time you rework what you're doing, you're getting further away from Golden State. Because the part of this people don't understand is their nucleus has been together now for a very long time. Klay Thompson, Steph Curry, and Draymond Green are the core of that group. And when they bring in the rest of the elite talent that take them to an altogether different level, they're building on a premise and an acceptance of selflessness there that's totally unique. So Boogie Cousins is either going to go along with the program or he's not going to be a part of what they do, and they'll survive no matter what. So every time you change anything substantially, you get further away from Golden State because they're doing what they do better the next year. And so anytime you change, I don't like it. And I felt like Houston was in a situation where they had that team beaten, and they had found a formula for defending Golden State, and it was P.J. Tucker at the five, Ariza, Bamute, C.J., and Harden together. And that group was as good from a net rating standpoint in the playoffs as any team. That lineup was special good, and it was in particular special good against the team you're trying to beat. So to lose the ability to put your best lineup on the floor, I don't care who you replace them with. I'm really concerned about that.
Let me get back kind of quickly to LeBron and the Lakers. I look at their roster. I watched him play in the finals and take some plays off defensively, guarding Draymond Green. And it dawned upon me, when they lose Julius Randle and they don't have a small ball five, that's going to be LeBron's new role. That's a way in which into his 30s he can always be the better player instead of matching up with the twos and the threes and I guess now fours, although there really aren't power forwards anymore in the NBA. Does that change your perception of what they're trying to do in L.A. if you can think that he becomes their small ball five?
Sure. I mean, and the Cavs played Bron at the five. It changes it only insofar as it helps me understand that you know where his real value ultimately will come. But it doesn't change the fact that the way the game is going to be played in all likelihood when he's overly engaged and effective is still going to have floor spacing on the court. Don't care what position anybody plays. If you play him off the ball, so it was interesting. When we were in Cleveland, his number one most efficient thing was being a slasher from the weak side.
Right.
Just in terms of by possession, that's what he was most efficient at. Well, that's great, but that means we need to trust somebody else to make decisions. And when it comes time to win meaningful games in the playoffs, coaches trust their best decision maker to make decisions. So you could say that that's Rondo, and that's fine. But once LeBron gets the ball, the defense is going to be very available because they're going to treat Rondo and JaVale McGee and Lance Stephenson differently than they would treat shooters. So I just think it'll be interesting to see how they augment the group. Certainly the guys they signed aren't the only people that are going to be on the floor. And I happen to be of the mindset that Brandon Ingram hasn't even grown into his body yet. And if they were to get rid of him early, it would be a big mistake because you don't even know what he is yet. And I think he can be special good alongside LeBron and Rondo, certainly. So they have pieces. It's just it's going to take time. And fortunately for them, he gave them long enough to do it.
Luke Walton, how difficult is his job?
Oh, man. He's the one who really got hit the hardest by any decision to bring in really strong-willed players. Now, Rondo and LeBron are both alphas to a huge degree, and they'll work their issues out because they believe in each other. But from a coaching perspective, it's really hard when you have that much personality in a locker room, and getting buy-in becomes tougher and tougher as you add more personality to the room. So I think Luke has his work cut out for him, but if anybody can figure it out from a human perspective, he's the one. I think he's really got a chance to be special as the coach in the league.
All right, let me ask you quickly, because you're in Vegas, David Griffin joining us. Rookie that has been most disappointing to you?
rookie in Vegas that's been most disappointing.
Yep.
I really, to be honest with you, I don't think you can be disappointing here. I don't think it can be meaningful that you're disappointing here. Certainly everybody's disappointed in what Trae Young has produced, but Trae Young had these same warts when you were drafting him and you knew it, and it was going to take time and you were going to need to build the varsity to support him, and the summer league team isn't going to support him, so you can't be surprised that he's struggling in the way he has. So to be honest with you, it's hard for me to look at summer league and say anyone's terribly disappointing. For me, I look at it from the standpoint of who in summer league is getting to play the same role today that they will play on the varsity, and what do they look like doing it? So when I look at somebody like DeAndre Ayton, by way of example, in Phoenix, what he produces now will be meaningful because he's playing a very similar role. And it's not always the case with a lot of teams.
All right, so the opposite of it is there anybody who, based upon role or based upon where they are right now, you're impressed in comparison to what you thought they would be when you saw them against better competition?
Totality of the Orlando team is a lot of fun to watch right now because Jonathan Isaac is healthy.
Yep.
You know, many, many people thought last year that he had the most upside of anyone in that draft. And that includes Tatum. That includes Fultz. He was just further away from it. But you're talking about a kid who's 6'11 with incredible length, who can dribble, pass, and shoot, who blocks shots, and you put him with Mo Bamba and all that length defensively. Obviously, Aaron Gordon not playing in summer league, but you can see very clearly the vision that Jeff Weltman and John Hammond have. It's going to be exactly what Milwaukee did. They're going to get incredible length and athleticism that they can just swallow you up defensively with, and then they're going to hopefully sprinkle in the skill set guys that can dribble, pass, and shoot. But they've got length and athleticism in spades right now, and it's fun to watch.
Great stuff from David Griffin. You can check out his show, Deals and Dunks, with Joel Myers on Sirius XM NBA Radio. All right, get back in there because this San Antonio-Portland game is very close. Pretty exciting, very well played. Appreciate you joining us.
Thanks so much, Doug.
People confuse initials and nicknames all the time. It's not the same thing. Initials are not nicknames. Joe Varden knows that. He covers the Cavs for Cleveland.com. He's got some great insight on LeBron James. He joins us now on the Doug Gottlieb Show. There's a three-hour podcast out there that, here's how good it is, Joe. I was having dinner last night in Los Angeles with a friend who lives in near the area where LeBron lives. And he's like, have you downloaded the podcast with Varden and those guys? I was like, I've heard some, but we have it at work. He's like, no, 3 hours. It's all really, really good. For people who want to get a hold of it, how do they do so?
Wow. Well, there's actually two of them that my colleagues and I had done. One was with Howard Beck, the full 48, which was in between games one and two of the finals. And that is a lot more about just what it was like for 4 years to kind of live together and live through the LeBron phenomenon. And we had a lot of fun with that. We also drank 3 bottles of wine while we were doing it, which was fun. And then the new one is actually through a local radio station, 92.3 FM in Cleveland, their iPod or their podcast channel. And that is where we kind of peel a couple layers back into what happened in Cleveland and what happened with LeBron and Kyrie and David Blatt and Ty Lue and Dan Gilbert and just kind of on down the line. But it's still, you kind of get that same flair of sort of the, I don't know, just the camaraderie that we had built through 4 years together covering this team. We were the three guys that stayed on the beat the whole time and traveled the country with LeBron and those guys and obviously really got to know him and know each other in a really good way.
Some of what I've heard, I can't tell you I've consumed all of it, but some of what I've heard paints the picture of LeBron as a little bit, one, very, very smart, cunning in fact, but at times can be petulant, spoiled, can throw fits. All sometimes though he does things for a purpose. Like how would you characterize to the person who hasn't seen the real LeBron? How How would you characterize LeBron James as a teammate throughout those 4 years?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex picture when it comes to LeBron. As a superstar athlete to work with, from my perspective, I could not possibly have been treated better. I've covered politics, I've covered sports, and LeBron was certainly my favorite subject to cover and to work with in my entire career. There's no doubt about that. As a teammate, he was probably at his best as a teammate when he had older players on the team that he respected in a certain kind of way. He needed to rely on those guys to create the right, loose, comfortable atmosphere in the locker room and away from the court. Guys like Channing Frye and Richard Jefferson and James Jones, they could bring some levity to the situation, and they could kind of invite everybody from the team, from all corners of the locker room, out, you know, to dinner and to people's houses. And, you know, they would invite themselves to Kevin Love's house and have the whole team come over, LeBron included. And you know, after a while, they start going to the Indians games when the Indians win the World Series and those kinds of things. That's when LeBron was at his best as a teammate. He was very hard on Kyrie. And at times, Kyrie had totally deserved it. There's no question about that. That's another longer discussion. This year, as a teammate, LeBron, it's hard because I think as a teammate, he really struggled this year. He struggled throughout the year. He was uncomfortable, which this is going to sound so crazy, but he had kind of lost his way as the kind of alpha leader of the team when Dwayne Wade came on and Isaiah Thomas and Jay Crowder and Derrick Rose. Like, these are guys that are established veterans that can't really be talked to in a certain way. And LeBron, of course, was clearly the best player and it was clearly his team, but he had kind of gotten away from just kind of really like enforcing his will as to how this was going to go. And then when all those guys got traded, like literally all of them, he tried to reassume that role. But these guys that they brought in, three of them were young, 25 years old, and one was George Hill, who he had known from playing against in the playoffs, but he just didn't really know the other guys in a way, and it had just become too much of a task to try to bring all this together in the 2 months they had before the playoffs started. So what LeBron ended up doing, by and large, was taking it upon himself. And the Cavs set up their team so that regardless of who was on the floor or what the other talent was, everything, literally every last little thing, was going to go through LeBron. And LeBron was incredible. He was sensational and carried this team back to a finals when no one thought they could make it. And but the LeBron, the teammate, had long been gone by the time that had rolled around.
Joe Vardon from Cleveland.com joining us. Doug Gottlieb Show. Why was he so hard on Kyrie?
Well, LeBron put words to it himself way at the beginning, early in that first season together, when he talked about bad habits. And the truth of the matter is that Kyrie had shown to be an incredible talent, brilliant offensive player, killer, all those things. But playing on a bad Cavs team, you know, I mean, pretty much, maybe with the exception of the Stepien years, the worst Cavs team in franchise history, that was Kyrie's team. And so he had developed a ton of bad habits, things that you just don't do to play winning basketball. And LeBron knew that he needed to kind of to cleanse Kyrie of that. But he also kind of overstepped in a way that there wasn't enough respect, I think, paid to just how good of a player Kyrie was. And this lasted a long time. I mean,
this lasted well into the 2016 year. Not quite, but almost up to the to where Kyrie, you know, knocked down that the game winner in game seven. I mean, LeBron would publicly praise Kyrie and talk about how he's a future MVP and all those things, but he also, like, almost akin to like mild hazing, like he would just kind of haze him and just kind of speak about him and to him in a certain way that rubs Kyrie the wrong way. And then also Kyrie, and this is just totally, I mean, a warped view, Kyrie resented how much power and sway LeBron had in the organization, like basically totally disregarding that you were talking about arguably the greatest player we've ever had, certainly the greatest player in Cleveland, you know, four-time MVP, two-time champion before that. And he didn't like it. He didn't like that reporters ran to LeBron when something happened politically that required some comment. He didn't like how much he didn't like that LeBron's friends were hired for jobs in the organization and on down the line. So this is something that festered over their time together. And in the meantime, they produced the single greatest comeback in NBA Finals history and gave a town something that no one born after 1964 had ever seen, period.
Joe Vartan joining us from Cleveland.com. A lot has been made of Dan Gilbert, of the fact that LeBron could never get over the letter, that Dan Gilbert, you know, wanted to make decisions, wanted his team back. What's the reality to who Dan Gilbert was in this entire story?
Well, Doug, that's a great question. And, you know, I try every chance I get to kind of set this straight. Like, the whatever animosity or whatever ill will that there is or was between Dan and LeBron in this second 4 years together, I call it overblown, because it's portrayed as though there was a falling out. Like, oh, you know, LeBron is just so furious with Dan or so fed up with Dan or whatever the case may be. And that just wasn't true. They agreed to kind of move past what had happened in the past, but they didn't shake hands and say, okay, let's be friends. Like, they didn't have a personal relationship when LeBron came back. LeBron did not come back because of Dan. And I think that LeBron was actually telling the truth when he said to Rachel at the start of the finals, like, I have a great working relationship with Dan. I mean, they didn't have any personal relationship ever. But, you know, Dan, for the most part, spent a ton of money and did what he said he would do, which is fund a team that was capable of winning. And LeBron did what he said he would do, which was come here and get that team to the finals and win. So if Dan and LeBron, like, had reached some kind of, like, new level of trust and friendship, maybe LeBron would have remained in Cleveland, maybe. But I just think this has a lot more to do about what LeBron wanted for himself and his family and kind of how he wanted to write his last chapter. And part of that, Doug, is he wanted to play for the Lakers. Like, he has always thought it would be really cool to play under that moniker, and now he's got the chance to do it.
Will it work? And here's why I ask, because I agree with you. You know, he had, like, Channing Frye, he had some of these great teammates who they respected him but didn't take everything too seriously and kind of understood. But And even though I think he respects Rondo and probably likes the grittiness and toughness of Lance and, you know, these guys that need to play well, that need to fit in, even JaVale McGee has seen – JaVale McGee might be the only guy who can have a good time and be a veteran. Then you have all these other young guys who he might like their talent, but, they're really young and they might revere him, but that doesn't mean they can be their best selves playing with him. Based upon what they currently have, how they're currently structuring it, do you think it'll work?
Well, do I think they're going to beat the Warriors this year? No, almost no matter what. I mean, now the Warriors would need two devastating injuries to kind of bring them back to the pack
instead of just the requisite one with five All-Stars over there. But I think this is a bigger discussion too. We were talking out here. I'm at the Summer League, and we were talking with some of the Lakers writers, and I won't name names because they got to work with that team now. But they were questioning, like, oh, you know, are the Lakers right now? Are they better than the Rockets? Are they better than the Pelicans? They kind of name like three or four teams other than the Warriors. And Jason and Lloyd and I, you know, the two of the guys that have watched LeBron do this for the last 4 years, just laughing at him. Like, you cannot bet against LeBron unless it's the Warriors, who have an unprecedented level of talent. You can't bet against him at any point because he's that good. So, yes, I think it can work. However, and I'll try to get to the point as quick as I can, we need to remember that in January of this year, the Cavs were trending in a way that they would not have made the playoffs.
No.
They were 6-13 at one point, and they had all these names, and it just wasn't working. And LeBron was in the locker room, and they could not win. And so I am fascinated, you know, that, like, LeBron may have to change a little bit kind of how he approaches things away from the floor just to make some of these guys feel a little bit better about things and try to kind of build up, you know, the team and the camaraderie component of this that it takes to be successful. So I think it will work, but I do absolutely recognize the challenge.
It's going to be amazing. What about the Cavs? I like their point guard. And I do think Kevin Love, it's going to be interesting what they do with Kevin Love. What do you think the process they go through is? Do they tank? Is that the plan? How do they plan to rebuild this thing?
Well, so, I mean, you know, we've taken like a tire iron to them over this. Just searching for every nook and cranny, every pressure point. Are you going to tank? Because that's kind of, you know, that's the common knowledge isn't the right word, but that's like the opinion out there. Like, oh, you lost LeBron, you have no chance, you have to tank. And they insist, including like the guys behind the scenes, they insist that is not immediately the plan. They feel like their talent is underrated. And they feel like the guys that they brought in, as it turned out, weren't great fits to play under the kind of pressure that it takes to play with LeBron, who's trying to go to a fourth finals and expect so much without time to gel. And they just think that those guys on their own aren't going that there's potential there. They also think, and maybe this is part of it, is market-wise, that you don't just trade Kevin, just trade him. You need to get you need to get the right pieces for him, and the market might not be there for him now. So there is a very viable case to be made to bring this team back, bring Kevin back, and see how it goes. You know, the East is going to be weak. There's two playoff spots that you know you think that might be there, and you know the rest of the league doesn't think the Cavs are going to, you know, be a candidate for him, but right now the Cavs kind of do, and there's no harm in trying it. And if things go awry, then you trade Kevin at the deadline, and you know you look for picks and those kinds of things, and you start the rebuild then. But if it works, Doug, what a story for Dan, and what a story for Kevin. And the thing they've been saying is, you know, these rebuilds are not guaranteed to work. Like, yeah, the Sixers are a heck of a story after just five awful, terrible, horrendous years.
Right.
And, oh, by the way, if they don't trade for Kawhi Leonard, they're probably not getting to the finals anyway.
Right.
I mean, like, that's how hard it is.
Right. And you know, and, like, look, they're betting on Embiid to stay healthy. They're betting on Ben Simmons to develop a jump shot. And look, that's the best. The Milwaukee Bucks, they tanked, and they got a great player out of it. But they were, you know, they still were out of the first round of the playoffs. I mean, still, it doesn't always work. It's a great point. Download those podcasts. It's an incredible conversation. Enjoy the Summer League, and we'll talk soon, Joe. Great stuff, man.
Okay, thanks for having me, Doug.
Joe Vardon, Cleveland.com. All right, that's been All Ball. I hope you've enjoyed it. Make sure you tell a friend. Download, subscribe, and rate. Hope you enjoyed it. I'm Doug Gottlieb.